and welcome to this week's edition of the Breakout Hockey Program. My name is Adam Summers, and as always, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us here on the program. If you'd like to get a hold of the show, you can do so in a couple of ways, as always. The first is email. Send an email to breakouthockey@radiostar.com, or you can follow along on Twitter, twitter.com/Adam_Summers. That's at Adam_Summers. So with that bit of housekeeping out of the way, well, it's been a few days. It's actually been a little bit under 2 weeks since the last time we all convened for this program. A lot has happened. If you recall, the last show that I recorded was on the eve of Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals, and well, the finals have been talked to death in a great many circles, so not going to spend the entire show talking about that, but we will put a bow, so to speak, on the Stanley Cup Finals. Also, several trades, some surprising, some not so surprising, but several trades, some pretty big-time trades actually took place last week heading into and throughout the NHL draft, so we'll talk about those trades, and we'll close out the show doing something a little bit different. We'll actually have a guest on the program to talk about the National Hockey League draft, several of the teams in particular, in terms of how they fared in their drafts, and some of the draft surprises, guys that got picked earlier than expected, and some guys that got picked much later than expected, including one top 30 prospect, a player who was projected to go in the first round that went almost 100 picks later than he was projected. So we will get into all of that. The guest for that segment will be Ryan Pike. Ryan Pike writes for thehockeywriters.com, covering the Calgary Flames, as well as covering all things prospects. He had a great many previews, profiles of draft prospects. He had his own mock draft, all those sorts of things. Ryan also does some work for the Calgary Flames official magazine and website in terms of chronicling their prospects there. So a good person to have on at this time of year. We'll get his sense in terms of how the draft played out, obviously, for the Calgary Flames. From my perspective, definitely interested in his thoughts in terms of the Chicago Blackhawks, how they did in the first round drafting Mark McNeil and Philip Deneau. And everything else that came out of the draft. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, I definitely want to, from my perspective, wrap up the Stanley Cup Finals. If you recall, on the last show, the bonus short show that we did, if you recall, I did that show from inside of a parking garage, sort of in transit. So hopefully the sound quality this week is a little bit better than it was in that show a couple weeks ago. But on that episode, we talked about the idea that going into Game 7, particularly for Vancouver, it was a game that was going to define one player's career to that point, that being Roberto Luongo. Also, it was the type of game that could very well define the tenure or just the identity of the franchise itself in Vancouver after 40 years. And really, I'm hard-pressed to disagree with, myself prior to Game 7, and that what we ended up seeing was a Vancouver Canucks team led by Roberto Luongo and the Sedins that was unable to finish the deal. This is a team that was the President's Trophy winner, as I'm sure you're all aware, a team that was the odds-on favorite to win the Cup and came very, very close in the first round. Much like Boston, actually, in terms of not making it out of that first round, and who knows what changes would have taken place throughout the offseason if they had not made it out of that first round. But they get into the finals and really collectively lay four eggs out of the seven games. The three games that they won were all very close games. So it's a situation where, and this is something we're going to talk about a lot more throughout the offseason. It's something that I foresee us spending a pretty close to a full episode on, and it may be a common theme throughout the offseason. The idea of windows. Windows to win a Stanley Cup. The window to win a championship. And that my philosophy, which I'm sure I've mentioned on this program before, and that you have a particular period of time, a finite window with a group of players to be able to really reach your potential and win the Stanley Cup, or at least make it to the finals. But really, all that matters is winning the Stanley Cup. Let's not kid ourselves. And when when you have that team that has that year, and I don't think anybody could argue that Vancouver, much like Washington in previous years, San Jose in recent previous years, that this was their year. Not to say that they aren't going to have a great roster going into 2011, 2012, and beyond. Not to say that they didn't have a great roster the couple of seasons before this year. But this was the year that the Vancouver Canucks were picked by almost everyone to win the Stanley Cup, and they ended up coming one game short, not winning the Cup. And really, with the exception of Detroit, obviously they won the Cup, and then the next year they made it to the finals and lost. You have the flip scenario for Pittsburgh, as they had the initial series and then the rematch the following year. But outside of those two teams, you look at many of the teams throughout the 2000s that had chances to win the Stanley Cup and didn't, particularly, well, really the last year before the lockout and post-lockout. Many of those teams have not fared well in the seasons afterwards, whether it be Calgary, which each year they for the most part, got progressively worse after they almost won the Stanley Cup in 2003. Ditto for Edmonton. That core group of players was never able to duplicate that that magical run they went on as the eighth seed. Obviously, they were not the team that was by any means favored to win the Stanley Cup, but they got there, they got extremely close, and were never able to replicate that. You look at the Ottawa Senators. They make it to the Stanley Cup Finals against the Anaheim Ducks. They don't win the Stanley Cup, and you look at the decay of that core group of players, and they've had to go into a rebuild. Obviously, you look at, as I mentioned, you have the back-to-back years of the Detroit and Pittsburgh series, but then you look at the Philadelphia Flyers, which we're going to get into when we start talking about the trades in a few minutes. The Philadelphia Flyers, again, they were an underachieving regular season team, as we've talked about before. Don't let the fact that they made it in via shootout on the last day of the regular season fool you. That was a team that was predicted by many people to make it to the Stanley Cup Finals, and even though they took quite the circuitous route to get there, they made it to the Finals. They were unsuccessful in winning the Cup. And a couple years later, for on-ice and seemingly off-ice reasons, they've blown up that team as well. So it's not a situation where particularly in the salary cap era, and yes, with the salary cap having taken the turn it has, and particularly the floor, we've kind of entered at least one-year mini-era as we wait and see what happens with the collective bargaining agreement. But it will be interesting to see going into the 11-12 season how Vancouver fares. Are they like Philadelphia? Are they like Ottawa? Are they like Calgary? Are they like Edmonton? Are they like so many other teams that in recent years have really continued or have started the slow slide to mediocrity, if not worse, with a certain core group of players? We'll find out. You know, maybe they end up being the exception to that rule. Maybe they're the Pittsburgh Penguins, and they come back the next year and win that Stanley Cup. Time, and unfortunately too much time between now and the start of the regular season and the playoffs, will tell the tale. But in some ways, and this is something that I've heard other people say over the last several days, in some ways the 2011-2012 season already started. I feel like there was we all went to sleep after the NHL awards. I would imagine some of us probably fell asleep during them, but we all got a good night's sleep after the NHL awards, and I don't know, I felt like I woke up last Thursday and the 2011-2012 season had already started. So many trades, you know, the NHL draft coming up on free agency in a few days as I record this, so It's all coming together to where you kind of turn around and wonder, why isn't there a hockey game that's about to start? Because everything else is, I guess as in every year, but it seems like this year more than ever, the next season, the build-up to it is already in full swing. And that was certainly not in any more evidence than it was last Thursday, as we touched upon, with the really two blockbuster deals, one of which, to me at least, really came out of nowhere. The Philadelphia Flyers dismantling their leadership core in terms of the man that wears the C and one of the men that wears the A for the Philadelphia Flyers. Both were shipped out with, I don't think, any more than 30 minutes in between the trades, as Jeff Carter was shipped off to the Columbus Blue Jackets, the long-rumored trade over the last week or so anyway, prior to the deal being made, as I said, sending Jeff Carter to Columbus for Jakub Voracek, as well as the 2011 first and third round draft picks. That first round pick Philadelphia went on to use on Sean Couturier. We may get into that a little bit with Ryan Pike coming up later. If not, I would imagine we'll probably have more draft discussion on next week's show. But the Flyers able to turn that pick for and use it on Sean Couturier, a guy that at the beginning of this past season was the number one ranked player by Central Scouting. So certainly a good pickup there, a good usage of that first-round pick, and as I mentioned, a third-round pick as well. But, as I said, the Philadelphia Flyers, were not done as they shipped Mike Richards to Los Angeles for Wayne Simmonds, top prospect Braden Schenn, who L.A. was loath to get rid of during right around the trade deadline, but this deal knocked their socks off, I guess. Also, an undisclosed draft pick included in that deal. So, really, as I said, blowing up the leadership core of a team that was one game away from winning the Stanley Cup just a little bit over a year ago. The spin coming out of Philadelphia is that this is purely a hockey decision, but so many rumors, so much innuendo, some things confirmed over the last couple of years as far as the nightlife tendencies of guys, really of Jeff Carter, Mike Richards, and several other guys on the team, that for whatever reason, this went beyond just nightlife and carousing, so to speak, and rumors of a rift, the locker room being split down the middle between sort of a Mike Richards, Jeff Carter stable of players and the Chris Pronger stable of players. Much talk of a rift between Peter Laviolette, the Flyers head coach, and Mike Richards that got to the point to where they were not on speaking terms, and seemingly in a situation that's pretty rare in this day and age for sports, the ownership or whoever you want to blame this on, if you want to use that terminology in the front office, decided to side with the coach Peter Laviolette and the coaching staff rather than the star player. In any event, what this means, well, for Columbus, is that they have a center that ostensibly they finally have their center to play with Rick Nash. I'm a little bit dubious of that in the sense that Jeff Carter is not exactly a playmaker. Jeff Carter is a guy that wants the puck. He's going to score goals, very similar to Rick Nash. So you're going to have a lot of firepower on that top line, but I'm not entirely convinced that Jeff Carter is the playmaking center that Rick Nash has always needed. The other interesting aspect, and it seems as though Jeff Carter is finally thawing a little bit or, in terms of his ice-cold demeanor after the trade. He really just went into hiding. Nobody heard from him for 3 or 4 days. Scott Housen was unable to get a hold of him, that being the Columbus Blue Jackets general manager, the coaching staff. Really nobody was able to get a hold of Jeff Carter as he was very angry. He had just really both Jeff Carter and Mike Richards had recently signed long-term deals that were going to keep them for many, many years in Philadelphia, if not their entire careers. And in the end, that certainly did not end up being the case. So Jeff Carter seems to be coming around to the idea of playing for the Columbus Blue Jackets, but some question marks there. And then on the LA side, I mean, getting Mike Richards is in some ways exactly what Philadelphia has needed. Some much needed offense. It gives them a vaunted 1-2 punch up the middle with Anze Kopitar and now Mike Richards. You're giving up quite a bit in Wayne Simmonds, a guy who you figure projects to be, after a couple years in the league, a second or third line guy that really, with his demeanor, his physicality, and his skills, he should be able to pot 20 to 30, probably closer to 20 to 25 goals a year. You give up on Braden Schenn, a guy who was amazing in last year's World Junior Championships, one of the top prospects out there, and a guy who most likely will be ready to step in one would think, and have a really good chance of cracking the lineup for the Philadelphia Flyers. It's really going to elevate, obviously Chris Pronger. You would think he is probably the odds-on favorite to be the captain of the Philadelphia Flyers. You've got other guys there in Danny Briere, Philly Leno if he re-signs. Claude Giroux and James Van Riemsdyk are going to get much more responsibility and ice time. And there's even rumors that Simone Gagné, who has indicated that he is not going to return to the Tampa Bay Lightning, may find his way back to his old team, that being the Philadelphia Flyers. So we shall see. Also on Thursday, Devin Setoguchi of the San Jose Sharks signed a 3-year contract at $3 million a year to ostensibly stay with that team for 3 more seasons. More on that in a few minutes. Also, Eric Brewer, this being on Friday, Eric Brewer re-signed with Tampa. Very good signing for them. He was great in the playoffs. This was a player that they acquired at the trade deadline, a blockbuster deal that worked out very well for Tampa Bay. Also, John Michael Lyles, kind of a surprise. Not a surprise that he's being shipped out, but in this current climate, as I mentioned, that we'll talk about, the idea that the salary cap is a hair over 64. The floor has now moved up accordingly to $48 million. So you would figure a team like Colorado, who is going to really have to struggle to reach that floor, would be a bit hesitant to trade away a player that is pretty effective, even though he's gone through his spells of being a healthy scratch with the Colorado Avalanche. But John Michael Lyles, certainly not a bargain basement player as far as contract is concerned. He gets dealt to the Toronto Maple Leafs with no salary coming back, just a 2012 second-round draft pick. So an intriguing move there. Then we go to Saturday on the actual draft day. Many transactions, but I just want to get into some of the more significant ones. For the Islanders, they traded defenseman Bruno Gervais to Tampa for future considerations. Like I said, a lot of swapping of draft picks. One interesting deal in that it's a first-round draft pick who has not panned out at all, that being Nikita Filatov, the left winger from the Columbus Blue Jackets, being dealt to the Ottawa Senators for a 2011 third-round draft pick. Obviously, that pick was utilized by Columbus on Saturday afternoon. But Nikita Filatov, really, this is a reclamation project for Ottawa, a low-risk, high-reward situation. If he's a bust, well, then it's what everybody expected. But if he can somehow recapture the promise that he showed in getting to the NHL, and if he can get his head together and be a guy that comes to compete every game, this could be a big-time scenario for the Ottawa Senators, getting a very promising offensive player. Other major trades that were finalized over the weekend, Brian Campbell of the Chicago Blackhawks, he of the $7.1 million cap hit with 5 more years left on his deal, dealt by the Blackhawks. Brian Campbell agreed to waive his no-trade clause to go to Dal Talon's Florida Panthers in exchange for Rostislav Olesh, who on a smaller scale was a salary cap problem for the Florida Panthers. He has 3 years left at $3.1 million per year. So on the Blackhawks' perspective, they do get rid of Brian Campbell, who you could argue was really their best defenseman last year, their most consistent defenseman, was at or near the top of the league in plus-minus throughout the course of the year. But the Blackhawks, in some ways, they couldn't turn down the opportunity to clear the salary cap space that they will need to be able to well, really, if they decide to go out and get anybody this year, but even more so to be able to re-sign Patrick Sharp, who will be a UFA after the 11-12 season. So Brian Campbell shipped out. And as I said, he goes to Florida where they, even though Dal Talon says this wasn't a motivation, they add a very good defenseman that will get them, inch them ever closer to the salary cap floor, so they're actually eligible to play games next year. Also, Robin Regier, and this was a move that was rumored throughout the week as Calgary had asked Robin Regier to trade his to waive his no-trade clause. He was hesitant to do so, took a couple days to think about it, see if there are any other deals available, but in the end, he accepted the trade to the Buffalo Sabres as Robin Regier, along with Aleš Kotalík, and a 2012 second-round draft pick go for young defenseman Chris Butler, who saw some time in the NHL last year for Buffalo, along with center Paul Byron. So an interesting move there. Really, I think, a great move for the Buffalo Sabres, getting a guy like Robin Regier to come in, most likely play big minutes alongside Tyler Myers, sort of show Tyler Myers the way. And really, I mean, Robin Regier has some good years left, and a physical shutdown defenseman like Robin Regier going to the Eastern Conference, I would imagine teams in the Buffalo Sabres division are not going to be they're not going to be overly thrilled about the prospect of having to play Robin Regier six times next year. Another protracted saga that finally came to a conclusion late last weekend was the trade of Ryan Smith to the Edmonton Oilers. If you had been following this saga throughout the week, rumors had trickled out that Ryan Smith had asked for a trade, that he was basically homesick, which isn't surprising when you saw his reaction to getting traded by the Edmonton Oilers a couple of years ago, but he wanted to return to his hometown team and his original team, that being the Oilers. He denied that report during the week, but as the week went on, it became apparent that was the scenario. Then the Calgary Flames got involved as well, which that made for a yet another venue, I guess, for the Battle of Alberta. And we'll touch on that, I'm sure, a little bit with Ryan Pike in a few minutes. But the end result of this, well, what we thought was going to be the end result on Friday night at the draft, was that Ryan Smith was going to be traded to Edmonton for Gilbert Brulé. That fell through, as there is an outstanding medical issue with Gilbert Brulé that did not allow that deal to go through. The trade still ended up happening after some tense moments, though. Ryan Smith dealt to Edmonton for former Blackhawk Colin Frazier and a 2012 seventh-round draft pick. So that was all of the draft-related transactions. Also, Kirk Muller of the Montreal Canadiens, who has interviewed seemingly for every head coaching vacancy in the National Hockey League over the last couple of years, signed on to become the head coach of the Milwaukee Admirals of the American Hockey League, them being the Nashville Predators affiliate in the AHL. An interesting move in that, for one, he's taking the step down, you could argue, I guess, a step down from being an assistant coach in the NHL to being a head coach in the AHL, with an obvious eye, Kirk Muller, that being having an obvious eye on getting a year or two in as a head coach on the AHL level, and following in the footsteps of so many coaches over the last couple of years and making that jump to being a head coach in the NHL. One would think that if he's going to do that, though, it would have to be with another team, not with the Nashville organization, because it does not seem at all like Barry Trotz is going to be going anywhere anytime soon. So, an interesting move by Kirk Muller. Also, a quick note on a very interesting scenario here in Chicago, as the Chicago Wolves, the longtime affiliate of the Atlanta Thrashers, announced that they will be, for at least 2 years, the American Hockey League affiliate of the Vancouver Canucks, who just happen to be the most hated rivals of the Chicago Blackhawks. So an interesting scenario. It's been a fun little social experiment to see how the fans in Chicago react, in that there are a lot of fans in the city that are Blackhawks fans as well as Chicago Wolves fans. And they don't know what to make of it. They say they're going to stop watching or following the Chicago Wolves, which, to me, and I talked about this on Twitter, the idea that it's a bit puzzling in that if you are a Chicago Blackhawks fan and you want to follow the AHL affiliate, that's never been the Chicago Wolves. They've never had an affiliation with the Blackhawks. You have the Rockford IceHogs, who are only 90 miles away, who are the Blackhawks affiliate, and you would think that I'm kind of surprised. I actually have been for the last couple of years that more Blackhawks fans don't make that 90-mile trek and follow the IceHogs more closely, or at least make the trek to Allstate Arena in Chicago and catch the IceHogs where they play the Wolves five times a year here in Chicago. So I don't know. It's been interesting to read, and if I was a Chicago Wolves fan, which I'm not, but if I was, I wouldn't let the affiliation get in the way of my fandom, but lots of different reactions to that here in Chicago. So, with that, I think what we're going to do now, pause for a brief second. You won't hear that pause at all. And we'll be back in just a moment with Ryan Pike of the Calgary Flames magazine, the Calgary Flames website, and thehockeywriters.com to talk about the National Hockey League draft and everything that went along with that. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, we are back here on the Breakout Hockey Program, as I mentioned just a couple of seconds ago. Very thankful to be joined by actually our first guest ever on the show, even though we've been doing it for, well, really a full hockey season and then some. Being joined by Ryan Pike of thehockeywriters.com, also of calgaryflames.com and the Calgary Flames magazine. So, Ryan, first off, thank you very much for joining us here on the program. No pressure, even though you're the first guest I've ever had on the show.
Happy to be here.
Really, we'll just jump right into it because there's so much stuff going on right now, and I know the main reason I wanted to have you on was to talk about last weekend's draft, but seeing as you are so closely connected with the Calgary Flames that you cover them on a regular basis, wanted to get your sense of the entire scenario that played out late last week with Robin Regier being asked to waive his no-trade clause. It seemed after a couple of days of hemming and hawing, trying to figure out what he wanted to do, he did agree to the deal that sent him to the Buffalo Sabres. I guess just the Regier deal specifically and just in general, the mood surrounding the Calgary Flames, whether what you're looking at is any sort of full rebuild or, as you mentioned to me just before we came on the air, if this is a scenario where Jay Feaster has really been left to pick up the pieces of a pretty damaged franchise, at least on the hockey side.
I'd say, at least right now, the mood is cautious optimism. The Flames, at least for the past few seasons, have sort of balanced between being a defensive team that could score and a scoring team that had to figure out how to play defense, dating back to, I guess, the 04 Cup run. It seems every year they sort of think, oh, we need to have more defense or less defense or vice versa. I think the main thing is sort of the feeling around the organization that if they had committed to what they were doing under Jay Feaster earlier in the season, they wouldn't have missed the playoffs by, I think they ended up missing it by 4 points this year, 3 or 4 points. So the idea is they want to shore up as much offense as they can. And with the salary cap situation being the way it is, especially coming up to July 1st when Alex Tanguay has become a free agent, there's a choice between keeping Rob Regier and, I guess, Alex Codleak in his $3 million AHL contract, or being able to sort of devote that money into getting Tanguay signed before he hit the open market. And it looks like they made the choice to keep Tanguay.
And like you said, in that deal, the fact that they were able to unload the Codleak contract definitely is a plus. You mentioned the idea of with Jay Feaster, the Flames not necessarily being able to enact whatever plan he wanted to put in place as maybe as early as needed to be done. At least to me, as somebody on the outside, it struck me as a little odd during the season that Jay Feaster was kept with the interim tag for so long, because at least on the outside, it seemed as though he had really taken ownership of that team in terms of the direction that hockey operations were going. Do you think that interim tag in any way hindered things, or was it just an organizational thing where the wheels sort of moved slowly to change direction?
I don't think it really hindered much of anything. As someone who spent a fair amount of time around the Salome last year, I can tell you firsthand the mood drastically changed the day after Daryl Sutter stepped down. It was as if everyone was waiting, the players, the ushers, everyone in the organization were waiting for the other shoe to drop. And then as soon as it did and they realized that no one was going to get traded, they weren't going to blow up the team, the coach wasn't getting fired, they weren't going to burn down the building with everyone still inside, everyone just sort of breathe a sigh of relief. And, you know, I think a lot of the moves that were made from December onward were sort of little tweaks. I think Feaster was very he was basically auditioning, but he was the entire time he was very straightforward about wanting to get the team younger and, for lack of a better term, cheaper. After the Regier trade, he made some comments on Calgary radio where he multiple times alluded to the term salary cap jail and the fact that the Flames, I think, the only reason they weren't technically violating the salary cap for the entire season was the fact that Damon Lanko was on long-term injury reserve. But as soon as he came back, they ended up having to make moves. And thankfully, those moves ended up making the team a little bit better and a little bit more mobile. And as a result of, you know, bringing in a guy off the injured reserve, you had to bring in a bunch of kids from the minor leagues who, shock and horror, actually turned out to be pretty decent hockey players. So it seems that the Regier move specifically is sort of designed to continue that trend. You're moving out a 33-year-old defenseman and Alex Kulik, who I believe is 31 or 32, and then bring in Chris Butler, I believe, is 22, and Paul Byron's 24. And I believe Paul Byron is all of 5'9 and 160 or 170 pounds. So it's a pretty distinct departure from the Daryl Sutter school of giant Western Canadian people. But I guess, you know, you don't know if it works until you try it. And, you know, it seems that Fischer's been pretty adamant that the old approach wasn't really working.
Yeah, well, and I think that's been borne out. It's interesting to hear you talk about the mood changing so quickly and so drastically, because that's certainly what it appeared to be just watching the Calgary Flames go through the season, because pretty much right after or right around the time that Sutter stepped down, that coincided with the crazy run that the team went on towards, I guess it would have been the middle of the season where, I mean, people were talking about, I'm sure you well know this, that Calgary was on track to be, you know, obviously one of the worst teams in the Western Conference. And the push they made, even though, as you said, falling a couple points short, I would imagine that alone is cause for optimism. And the fact that for a team that many people were saying was very, very weak, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but that they were very weak on the prospect side, seemingly, that the fact that some guys were able to step in, and the fact that, and we'll sort of transition to the draft here, that to me at least, they hit a home run drafting at 13, getting Sven Barchi in the first round.
Sven Barchi, the Flames, you know, coincidentally, last year the Flames drafted, they had no first round pick. I believe we traded for Ole Jokinen. We had no second round pick. I believe we traded that to Chicago for something at some point. I forget what exactly we got for the 2000 second round.
But could that have been involved in the Bork deal at some point, maybe?
Yeah, but as a result of the wheeling and dealing that Sutter did do, we ended up with two draft picks in the third round. And the odd thing was we drafted Max Reinhardt, who is a kid out of Kootenay who played his father's former Flames and Canucks player, Paul Reinhardt. He was on, I believe, the 86 and the 89 Cup teams the Flames were on, or the Cup final teams. And they also drafted another kid from Kootenay, Joey Leach. And both of those players played rather extensively against Portland in the WHL finals. And so, you know, going into the draft, my main thought was, you know, the Flames, they're going to always be a team that drafts a lot of Western Canadians simply because, you know, they own a WHL team. They have the luxury of seeing these guys come through their building. They share some office staff and some, I believe, some scouts, if I'm not mistaken, with the WHL team. So there's a lot of crossover between the Hitmen and the Flames, but they had the luxury of having all these really good young players come in. And, you know, throughout the year they saw a lot of Sven Barchi, and they saw, you know, while they were scouting their existing draft picks, a lot of Sven Barchi and another player they drafted in the fourth round, or second round, Tyler Witherspoon. And as a result, you know, I was hoping against hope that they'd pick up someone like Sven Barchi. I think a player I thought they might get because it was sort of more along the lines of the old time Flames players was a kid out of Saskatoon named Duncan Siemens, who ended up going to the Colorado Avalanche. But no, Barchi, he was fantastic in the WHL finals. He's a spark plug. He's not giant. He's not Western Canadian. He's a Swiss kid. He's not 200 pounds. He's like, I think, 180. But he's, you know, quick as a hiccup, and, you know, he seemed like a complete pain in the butt to play against. And, you know, when you're, you know, you don't have a lot of players with a lot of offensive skill, you don't have a lot of players with, you know, a lot of top two line potential, it's kind of nice to get someone with a little bit of flair in their game.
Well, and do you view his development track somewhat similar to his Portland Winterhawks teammate Nino Niederreiter, in that obviously he's a year behind Niederreiter, and it sounds at least that Niederreiter is going to have a good chance to crack the lineup possibly with the Islanders this year. You think Barchi's on the same trajectory, where he probably a year or two away?
I'm not going to say anything for sure. He looked really good in the playoffs, and I think he could probably benefit from another year of seasoning. But, you know, when you're pulling, I think he was the Western Conference Rookie of the Year. He was, I think he narrowly lost the WHL Rookie of the Year award. But he got, I think, something like 80 points and I think either 20 or 30 goals this year. So he had a phenomenal adaptation to the Western, you know, the Western Hockey League and the North American style of game. So I think given the fact that the Flames are really trying to, you know, not so much rush prospects, but sort of get younger and get faster, I can't imagine Barchi's not going to get a long look at camp. I've been told apparently he got drafted on Friday, and on Saturday the Flames already had a contract over for him.
Wow. So they're definitely high on him then.
Either that or they don't want to repeat a Tim Erickson situation. But
exactly. And that's one of the things that I briefly wanted to get into as well, just because it seemed from the outside as though a scenario that devolved rather quickly, but is this a situation where shortly after he was drafted, it became apparent that he had one team on his mind and that team was not the Calgary Flames?
It's hard to say because there's not a lot of contact with a lot of the European players, and the Flames as an organization have, at least during the Sutter years, tended to shy away from drafting as many European players. I believe we have a goalie in our system who's from Finland, and I think one or two fringe players are sort of bouncing in and out. But, you know, their mode of development dating back as far as Oleg Saprykin in the late 90s has been, if we draft someone from Europe, we're going to do our darndest to get them to come over to North America and play in a WHL team. I think they did the same thing with Michael Backlund a few years ago where they were facing some roadblocks with some of the people in the Swedish hockey Illuminati, for lack of a better term, you know, people in the Hockey Sweden organization. I forget exactly which team it was. I think I forget what his club team was, but he wasn't getting a lot of ice time and he wasn't developing the way they thought he should. So he came over for the World Juniors 1 year and then he just never left. They signed a contract and I think they flew him to Long Island to play a hockey game before they sent him to the WHL because they felt, you know, the European game is so much different than the North American game that they're a lot more comfortable developing prospects in North America. So I don't know. I think Erickson, he's always struck me as a brilliant hockey player. You know, I venture to say even more talented than his father was, but no one really knows how good he is because he hasn't really played a lot of North American hockey at all. And it's really hard to compare how he would he'd fare against other prospects.
One quick other draft pick I want to talk about before we transition away from Calgary. Marcus Granlund, obviously a last name that a lot of people are familiar with coming from drafts of recent years. But another, as you said, sort of a departure from the old way of doing things in Calgary. Another non-Canadian, a Finn, and not a particularly large man, 5'11", somewhere between 160 and 170 pounds. Your thoughts on that pick pretty much halfway through the second round?
I was fairly pleased with it. I you know, at first thought, I thought that the first round pick of Barchi might have been an aberration, but traditionally the Flames have been pretty good at finding good players in the later rounds, and this is another example of that. Like, Granlund's got a lot of upside. I think you know, he's always going to be in his brother's shadow, at least until he's able to sort of come in and do things on his own terms. They believe this year or next season he's supposed to be playing on the same team as his brother. So hopefully they won't be trading wacky lacrosse goals or anything. But I don't know. I think it'll be a very unique situation for them because, you know, they're both, you know, really talented hockey players. And it's going to be interesting to see how someone like Granlund can sort of change the culture around the Flames in terms of, you know, how, you know, completely Western Canadian they've been for the last, like, probably 5-10 years.
So I guess to put a bow on the whole Calgary situation, is this a team that you look at and think they're going to have a legitimate shot to make the playoffs next year? I mean, as we talked about, they're only really a few points out from making it this past season, but it's this in-between, this culture change, this I would imagine that Jay Feaster would probably say the same thing that several other general managers have said over the last week or so, that it's not a rebuild but a reload. Are we looking at a couple-year wait to see them back as contenders in the West?
I think a lot depends on how the defense goes. As much as losing Rob McGeer gives, you know, outside of Jay Bouwmeester, you know, I think there's a lot of people in Calgary who'd want to lose the $6.8 million contract or $6.7 million contract that Bouwmeester has. They're probably not going to find a lot of takers for him, so moving Regier is probably the best bet if you want to change the culture around your team and your back end. He's, I think, the second most experienced player on the team outside of Jerome McGinley, and I don't think he's going anywhere. But just the idea of being – they want to change the culture and they want to reload, so to speak, and that's great. But I think next year, looking at it, the biggest question mark because of the move is the defense. Regier ate up a lot of minutes against a lot of tough competition. I think in terms of strength of opposition, he was like sixth in the entire NHL for defensemen, and that's not something you can really replace by committee. It depends a lot on how bottom four defensemen step up. No one really knows who the other four defensemen are going to be right now. We got, I think, Sarich and Giordano and I think Brett Carson, who we got from Carolina on a waiver claim, and Bouwmeester. And then no one really knows what the blue lines look like. And outside of Bouwmeester and Giordano and I guess maybe Sarich, that's kind of a weak group compared to what they had last year. Strangely enough, I'm not really that concerned about offense. I think you got Tanguay long-term, and he showed a lot of chemistry with the Ginla. And they managed to get Michael Backlund into some good offensive situations. So that could, if they continue showing chemistry, that could really help. Their second line down the stretch last year, I think, was Bork, Jokinen, and Curtis Glencross, and they showed just flashes of just amazing brilliance. With the bottom six, a lot of it depends on who they move and who they keep. If they can find someone who wants Matt Stajan and his $3.5 million contract, or if they want to bury him in the minors, or if they can figure out a way to use up their cap space. I think depending on whether or not they find something to do with Stajan, they have with him they have almost $8 million in cap space. Without him, they have almost 10.5. So potentially they could bring in an impact forward, or they could bring in a $2 or $3 million body to shore up their defense. In short, I think a lot of it depends on what you think the Flames were down the stretch. Was that an aberration? Was that just a team sort of, on a giddy thrill of, the parents being away for the weekend so they can run wild? Or was that, the team actually living up to their potential?
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because we see that a lot in hockey and other sports, the idea of a team, well, obviously in the situation of Calgary, like we've talked about, the change in leadership in the front office, but also that idea that, well, once you're out of it, or at least it looks at the time like you're out of it, well, then the team starts playing looser and go on a run, and then sometimes that, like you said, that can look like a mirage. I do think that, and we've seen this in Chicago, which is the other team we're going to talk about in a minute, but if there is a summer to be able to quote-unquote unload contracts that are damaging to your cap structure, this certainly seems to be the summer to do that. So I would imagine if, like you talked about, if they're looking to move a contract like Stajan, this would probably be the best chance they'd have if that's what they want to do. Moving on to Chicago, who, as I mentioned, moved Brian Campbell, a contract that many people thought was very much unmovable. Don't know what you think about their draft, but I personally, at the very least, with the 18th pick overall, I was thrilled with them being able to come away with Mark McNeil. The other pick, the pick that they basically traded Troy Brouwer for, Philip Deneau, I was a little bit surprised just because it seemed as though he was a guy who was projected to be going closer to maybe the middle part of the second round. I guess just your thoughts on both of those guys, and if you think they were picked appropriately by the Hawks as far as kind of where they slot in ranking-wise.
I really like McNeil. He's going to be a really good hockey player. He's got some size. He's got some finesse to him. And he's a guy that I think a lot of people in mock drafts were saying he'd probably go higher than he would go. He ended up sliding down a little bit. I think he was projected by most places to go somewhere in the low teens. He ended up going in the high teens. But, he's going to be a really, really versatile center. Deneau seems like kind of more of a project, and I think it's probably something that one of the scouts sort of saw something in special and thought, oh, here's something we can work with that would complement things we already have in our organization. Because, I don't know, those are some good picks. There's a lot of drop-off in this draft between really the top five or the top eight and everyone else, but it seems like there's a handful of teams. I think Colorado did really good, really good job at finding some really skilled players outside of the top 10. I think Calgary did a great job, and I think Chicago did a fantastic job, especially with both of their picks being in the later part of the first round, finding, you know, complementary skilled players without really finding guys that'll, you know, make some of their existing prospects, you know, duplicated.
Yeah, it definitely seemed, just to echo what you said, that the there wasn't a huge drop-off necessarily from, and this seems like such a wide swath, but from almost from like 10th, 11th, all the way down to 40th, you had guys who were projected to go middle or lower in the first round, drop to at least the second round, if not further, and you had sort of the opposite happen, like we talked about with Philip Deneau. The second-round picks for the Blackhawks, it was interesting to me in that with Adam Clendening going 36 overall, I think a lot of people, myself included, were looking to see if the Blackhawks were going to take Thomas Yurko with that pick. Obviously, he went one pick ahead of that to the Detroit Red Wings. Clendening joins a pretty crowded prospect blue line for the Blackhawks. They cleared that out a little bit, actually, today. Kind of surprising move getting or not qualifying Brian Connolly, who was an AHL All-Star last year, and a lot of people are saying had an outside chance to make the team. But in any event, Clendening going 36 overall, and Brandon Saad going 43rd overall to the Blackhawks, another guy who at least some draft boards had going possibly going in the top 30, going in the first round. To me, those seem to be pretty solid picks.
Yes, honestly, Saad's probably going to be one of those nice second-round steals because I was astonished that he was still around. Like, I think Calgary drafted 45, and I was looking around at that point going, wow, there's a lot of really good players left. I think a lot of the players from the St. John Sea Dogs team that won the Memorial Cup this year, they were all projected to go fairly high, you know, possibly because their team won the championship and they all looked great in the process. But a lot of those guys end up sliding back. I think Nathan Beaulieu, a really strong defender on that team, ended up going to Montreal, I think, somewhere in the middle of the round. In the middle.
Yeah, 17th overall, actually, right in front of where McNeil went, and you were reading my mind because I was going to ask you about Beaulieu.
And yeah, no, Beaulieu was fantastic. And then Zach Phillips, who was another guy who, you know, people were saying, you know, looking at Calgary, saying, oh, you need some skill. The three or four names that were mentioned in terms of skill forwards were Barchi, McNeil, and guys like Phillips. And I was honestly kind of amazed considering how much people were raving about how poised Phillips was in the playoffs that he went in the second round rather than someone snapping him up in the first round.
Yeah, I was actually with Phillips. I was a bit surprised as well, and sadly, as I've lamented here on the show several times, here in the States, really the only time we get a chance to see any Canadian Hockey League action is the Memorial Cup. But I thought Zach Phillips looked pretty damn good in that tournament, and I was a bit surprised that he fell as far as he did as well. I guess along those same lines, but certainly more dramatic, who do you think, or who are you most surprised by how far they fell compared to their projections? To me, the guy that just having watched a lot of the coverage leading up to the draft and having looked at draft rankings and seeing this guy ranked by a lot of people top 30, maybe at worst top 45, was Seth Ambrose, who, if I'm not mistaken, fell all the way to 128th overall. Was there anybody else like that that sort of caught your eye as a surprise slider throughout the draft?
I was actually pretty surprised to see how far Rocco Grimaldi fell because he was pretty highly touted. People were saying, you know, he sort of knocked him for his lack of size, but I'm amazed that a guy with that kind of skill fell that far.
When he was, and that's exactly, you're exactly right, because a lot of people were saying leading into the draft that if this guy just had, you know, if he was even 5'10", that he would be very, very near the, you know, the top of the draft strictly in terms of his skill. Obviously a guy who's pretty damn motivated and is a guy who certainly isn't going to be lacking for work ethic. To me, it was a perfect pick in the sense that he's a Dale Talon type of hockey player. That the fact that he fell probably surprised me as well, but the fact that Dale Talon took him while he was available, I guess it didn't shock me too much.
Well, the thing that really strikes me about that is I believe Grimaldi's a U.S. national development player. And the Flames, strangely enough, I think they're third or fourth round. Their, one of their picks was a kid that's legitimately 5'6", 145. I think they call him Little G. I forget it. John Goudreau. He was the USHL Rookie of the Year playing out of Dubuque.
Yeah, exactly. 5'6". I've got it in front of me. At least they have it listed 5'6", 137 pounds.
Yeah, and that's a kid who's, you know, he's, I think, barely 17. He's turning 18 in, before the end of the summer. So he's barely draft eligible. And I think he has another year of the USHL left. And then he's doing 4 years of college. So at one point you're going, you know, guys like him and Grimaldi, you're going, why would you take a chance on a guy like that? You know, he's so small. He's so young. But, you know, these are guys that by the time they're actually going to get into your organization and start stepping in, they're going to be, you know, 22, and they'll be 5 years removed, and you'll be able to sort of guide their training for that long. So in that case, it's sort of, you know, the hockey ops has a lot more of an opportunity to sort of mold them into the kind of player they want. So, you know, in that kind of case, you know, you don't want a finished product. You want a kid who has some flashes of brilliance that you can mold. And, you know, the Flames have had a couple guys like that. Currently they have John Ramage in their system, who's the son of Rob Ramage, who won 2 Stanley Cups. And I believe John was the captain of the U.S. Team, the U.S. Under 18 national team that won the gold medal, the U.S. World Junior team that won the gold medal, and then I believe they won the bronze medal this time. And he's, you know, he's one of those guys they targeted as a leadership guy, but also a project. And I find it kind of nice that they didn't shy away from guys like him and Goudreau simply because, oh, they're in college or they're a little bit smaller.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And it seems as though, the teams, at least in recent years, that seem to be the most open-minded as far as, like you said, not pigeonholing themselves into, well, we've got scouts that are focusing on this particular league or this particular conference in one league, or are sort of, leaving the U.S. college hockey scene, without really scouting it as strongly as they should. It seems like those are the teams that kind of have not been having great draft success, whereas the teams that have really been, and I guess a lot of it is the resources that are available to them to really scout at every possible level, but whether it be American players or even more so just U.S. college hockey, it seems as though teams are having more and more success mining that field.
Just an example of that, the Flames actually, I think yesterday announced their new assistant general manager, who is a guy, they actually poached the head scout, or head pro and college scout from the Boston Bruins. You know, the guy has a Stanley Cup ring, and Boston has a tremendous, tremendous track record the last 5 years or so in terms of finding good hockey people wherever they are and sort of, you know, reining them into the organization. So, That's going to probably be a move that pays off dividends with the Flames in a while, simply because, you know, they've been, you know, trying to dip their toe into this, the U.S. hockey pool for a while. And, you know, they've had a few successes, and I think they really want to, you know, develop as much of a U.S. prospect base as they can.
Definitely. Now, as we get ready to pretty much wrap this up, we haven't really talked a whole lot about the top of the draft, the top 5 or 10 picks. I guess just briefly, when you look at those guys, how many of them do you think are really ready to step into the NHL? I mean, are there guys that were taken at the top of the draft that you think are risks? Because every time we look back, you can look back, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, and you see some of the guys. A perfect example, actually, is Cam Barker, who was drafted 3rd overall several years ago and is on a second team and is about to be bought out. Do you see guys, with the exception of Gabriel Landeskog, I think most people agree is going to step right into the Colorado Avalanche, are there any other guys that you see really ready to step into the NHL and really have a chance to win a spot right out of training camp?
I don't know. As much as I like the Nugent Hopkins pick, I think it's the right player for the wrong team. The Oilers have never really had a problem with having, you know, top-flight defensive talent. You know, they've had, I think the last 3 or 4 drafts, they've done a phenomenal job bringing, you know, skilled defensive players into their system and bringing them right in. They have horrendous defensive coverage. Their problems start from the back end, not on the front line. So, it might have been a situation where you want to grab someone like an Adam Larson that you can build an entire blue line around rather than grabbing another skilled forward who's going to have to battle for ice time with your Halls and your Eberles and all those guys, because, you know, there's only so much ice time to go around and so much power play time to go around. And if the team continues to sort of paddle around in the shallow end of the Western Conference, you're going to have a lot of people sort of wringing their hands wondering, you know, why they want to keep playing at Edmonton for another few years. Beyond that, I was really surprised how far Couturier fell, but I think that was a fantastic get at number eight. I'm amazed he fell that far. I guess it shows that people are sort of looking at guys like Strome and Murphy as a little bit better than a lot of people thought they were. But
it was interesting to see because Couturier, and correct me if I'm wrong, but was he not before the start of the season the number one North American ranked skater with Central Scouting? If he wasn't, he was right near the top.
He was either one or he was two. He was definitely way up there. I think he was above Landeskog. He was definitely above Huberdeau. Huberdeau's stock went way up because of the Memorial Cup. But yeah, I think the only guy who might have been behind the whole year was Nugent Hopkins, but he was, you know, right on his tail the whole year, and then all of a sudden, poof, he drops to eight.
Yeah, and it didn't seem, and again, sadly, here in the States, I don't have the access to be able to see anywhere near as much as I would like, but it did not seem as though there was a real tangible reason that Couturier fell as far as he did. I mean, I guess in some ways you could compare it to the previous year where Cam Fowler, who really early in that season, it seemed like he was destined to go no lower than third, and he fell all the way to 12th.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a lot of I really thought the top five would go, you know, in the top five in terms of, you know, your Nugent Hopkins, Larson, Landeskog, Couturier, and Huberdeau would go, you know, it's a question of what order they go behind Nugent Hopkins, but, you know, I thought I didn't really see Larson falling to four, but I think that's a really good fit, and, you know, I think Colorado definitely, I think they got a defenseman later on who was really good. I think that, yeah, they got Siemens later on, who was a pretty good get, especially, he's, you know, going to complement Landeskog really well. But in terms of, you know, grabbing guys, I was surprised to see as much jostling the top eight as I did. And I think, you know, the hindsight's going to be 20/20 and probably like give it probably 3 years, and you're going to have some GMs and head scouts sort of wringing their hands in some cases over the decision they made.
All right, well then to wrap it up, and I guess I know this is not an easy question, and it's really a question without a great answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway, since you mentioned the fact, you know, I'll have to revisit this in 2 or 3 years. If you were press on it right now, what do you think we'll be saying about this draft, let's say 3 years from now, in terms of the guys that went, particularly the guys that went near the top, and kind of how it's all going to shake out? And I know it's a horrible question to ask, but there it hangs.
Well, I think it's going to go down as one of those drafts that probably going in, people thought that you'd have five really good players and then, you know, maybe another, for lack of a better term, 40 guys after that who would be, you know, serviceable. I think the drop off between the main group and the rest of them will be a lot less than people think. I think you have a lot more finished products in the first, you know, part of the prospect phase. I think Landeskog's basically ready to go right now. He doesn't really need that much more polishing. You know, a lot of the guys in the outside of the top five will need some time to work on stuff and to sort of be molded. But there's a lot of, I would say there's a lot more, unrefined raw talent in the draft than there is in most other years. And I think most other years have a lot more, finished products in them already. And I don't think we're going to see a lot of guys from this group in the NHL right away, but you're probably going to see, I don't know, probably about 10, 15, you know, really quality guys in a few years that will really be able to help other teams. Unfortunately, I don't think you're going to see anyone but Landeskog and maybe two, three other guys next season.
Tremendous stuff, Ryan. I thank you very much for joining us. As I said, the first interview on the show. Make sure to get your plugs out. Tell everybody again where they can find your stuff, and if you have anything in particular cooking that people can look for maybe in the next week or two.
I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff at the hockeywriters.com next week or so, especially leading up to the prospect camps and all the free agent stuff that'll basically start exploding come July 1st. I think I have a review of the draft from the Flames' perspective. You know, was it good? Was it bad? Did the Flames get what they needed? If not, why not? Sort of a review of the whole crazy weekend in depth. That's up on the front page of the Hockey Writers right now. And probably within the next 2-3 days, I'll be able to have my review of what the Flames should be doing with the free agent season in terms of filling some holes in the lineup and, you know, making it so that the team can ideally live up to that kind of potential they showed in the December through March portion of the season.
Great. Well, thank you again very much for joining us, Ryan. We'll have to do this again maybe as we get closer to training camp breaking, see what's going on with not only the Calgary Flames prospects, but also the rest of the prospects getting ready to try to make their NHL team. So everybody, as we've said, check out Ryan's stuff on thehockeywriters.com, also on the Calgary Flames website, and everywhere else that Ryan is getting his stuff out there. So with that, I think we're going to close out the show for this week. We'll definitely be back again next week talking about the free agent frenzy, or lack thereof. I guess we'll either be able to talk about how exciting it was or commiserate about how really nothing happened and Darren Drager was just checking his BlackBerry on TSN for 7 hours. So with that, we'll close it out. As always, thank you for listening, and make sure to do one thing. Keep it simple.